So welcome, everybody, to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's, in my restaurant. It's all based on her family recipes from Alexandria, Egypt. So thank you for eating. I'm glad people are enjoying the food and cocktails. We've turned this into a literary salon, so it's a safe place for authors to come and celebrate their work. You are, I believe, 214 says that I've interviewed since we've started here. We have a podcast now, so this will be on the podcast. It's Elaine's Literary Salon. If you go to elainesliterarysalon.com, you can find our upcoming schedule. And I think we have 70 or 80 podcasts that are up there now. Hope Gibbs is our PR director. She's here. Hi, Hope. She's got us at number one on Apple and Spotify for our literary podcasts. So, yeah, please check us out. So Becca Weasty is an author whose latest novel, Human of the Year, earned a Kirkus Star, with a review calling it, quote, a patiently detailed and heartfelt book, end quote. Her debut novel, The Unsent Letters of Lucy Pryor, earned praise as, quote, deeply introspective and emotionally resonant, end quote, and, quote, an explosive fiction debut. I love that, end quote. Her second novel, Fireflies in a Jar, was welcomed as, quote, warm, funny, and quietly heartbreaking, end quote. Those are great reviews. In 2025, Becca's debut short story collection, My Side of the World and Other Tales of Death, was a finalist for the ReaderView's Short Story Collection of the Year. Becca's an award-winning visual artist who exhibits her visual work frequently in regional and national shows. Born in Texas and raised in Virginia, Becca earned a BA from the University of Mary Washington and an MA from George Mason University. An enthusiastic traveler, avid reader, nature lover, and lifelong cinephile, Becca lives with her husband and their rescue Shiba Inu in Northern Virginia. She's here to discuss her latest novel, Human of the Year. So please welcome Becca. So it's a pleasure to have you here. Congratulations on the book. It's exciting.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thanks to you and to Hope for all of the advance work on putting this event together as well. I love that in Northern Virginia, we have so many readers, but also so many authors, and having a place where they can convene is just, it's wonderful.
It's my guilty pleasure. You know, the restaurant's my wife's thing, but being able to sit down with authors, and it's so interesting because we get readers in here all the time, like every day, readers and authors downstairs, and they come up here and everybody's just so interested in sort of the story behind the story and how this magic gets created, because we're all readers, you know, but how that comes to fruition is very different for people, and it's always interesting. So let's peek behind the curtain. Why don't you tell us Human of the Year? What's it about?
So Human of the Year is a contemporary family drama set in Montgomery County, Maryland. And it's the story of an adult brother and sister, Matt, and his younger sister, Jenny, who are reunited after 20 years. Matt's been incarcerated for a crime he committed when he was in high school. And his parents cut him off when he was convicted. So Jenny's been his only point of contact outside of prison the entire time. When he's released on parole, Jenny invites him to live with her husband Hector, who's from Sonora, Mexico, and their six-year-old daughter Julia, neither of whom Matt has ever met. And so the book takes place over the course of his first year post-release, and statistically that is when people are most likely to be rearrested. So it's a big milestone to make it to your first year. And it's told from alternating points of view. So you get Matt's point of view, which is starting out a little closed off emotionally because of his experiences. And then you get his younger sister, Jenny, who's the go-getter project manager. If she just tries hard enough and means well enough, she can keep him out whether he wants to be free or not. She's going to keep him out. So as a reader, you get the balance of both of those perspectives.
I mean, it sounds really interesting, and I'm excited to dig into it a little bit. How long did this take you to write?
So I am a very disorganized writer and artist. I wait for things to come to me. And so most of my stories are not intentional, whether they're my short stories or novels. They come to me in snippets and I will work on them over time. And eventually enough scenes will come that I'll sort of say, oh, those all kind of go together as a narrative, and I'll Frankenstein them together as a narrative. And then in the revision and editing process is where the story really comes to life when I get to know the characters. This book, it's going to sound like I worked it on for a long time, because the first snippet was a confrontation scene that's actually still in the book, and that was in 2006.
So it's just this compilation of these scenes and things that come to you, and at what point do you say, okay, this is a cohesive narrative?
I have a million notebooks. I actually posted a picture on Instagram recently of how many notebooks. I have one in my purse now. I always have a notebook with me because ideas come and go. And Anne Lamott, who wrote a book, Bird by Bird, about storytelling, says never be without something to write down your ideas because easy come, easy go. And so what I'll do is I'll just capture all of these ideas. And sometimes it's a fully fleshed scene. And sometimes it's just a character sketch. I'll have an idea. Sometimes it's fully formed dialogue and I'll either hear the dialogue or almost see it like I'm watching a movie and I'm just transcribing or capturing it. And it always hits sort of a critical mass of these things go together and my, you know, process just starts connecting. So this started with just a short story that was a confrontation scene from Matt's point of view. And over the years, it would just kind of come back into my head of, but what precipitated that? What happened after? Was she being unfair to him in that confrontation? And so these stories, whether it's short stories or novels, they hit this mass where I think there's something really there. Those do actually go together. And that's when I sort of sit down and start saying, let's see what really happens with this. But I'm not an author who can plot. I cannot do the chapter by chapter outline that some of my fellow authors can do. I let the story take shape and lead me where I go, especially because during revisions, I love the surprise of someone's feedback telling me I wanted more of this or more of that. And I just let the story take shape. So I'm open to the inspiration and I just try not to force it because the ideas come and I embrace that.
You know, it's so smart. I've interviewed hundreds of writers and hundreds of writers outside of like the podcast too. And everyone does it a little differently. And it's so magical how it happens that this idea that there's like one way to write or one process. I mean, I have a very small, I have a big writer's group and a small writer's group and every single person writes differently. Mm-hmm. And sometimes radically differently. So I'm interested, like, you know, when the first snippet comes to you, because okay, I'm asking one question I ask everybody. I don't pre-plan questions, but I always ask, where does story come from? And I get some really different answers for this one. Where do you think this magic comes from? Where do these fictional characters, how are they born?
For me, it's the same. Again, I'm a visual artist as well. And sometimes it's after I meditate daily, but I also will have vivid dreams. Or I'll just be out on a walk exercising or in the shower or in the car or supposed to be concentrating on something at work, but my mind wanders and the stories just come to me. And, you know, Pablo Picasso said that inspiration will find you, but it has to find you working. So I find that if you just keep an open mind, everything has the potential to be either visual art or a story, but I do have to capture it immediately. And so I do, whether it's putting a sketch in a sketchbook and maybe that becomes a full painting later, or it's just writing down a snippet. And sometimes it's little things will inspire suddenly. And sometimes it's just a completely intrusive thought that you're not looking for. And I multi-track, I'm writing about 8 different stories right now. And the other night we were at a concert with some friends, you know, for some 90s jam bands. And all of a sudden, fully formed dialogue for a short story about an intelligence community veteran came into my head. And so on the way home, I was like, I better get this into my notes on my phone as quickly as possible or it's gone. So I don't know where it comes from. I just think as an artist, you need to be open to it. And I'm a big Frida Kahlo fan. And she always said, I don't know why I paint. I just know I must. And so for me, it's just the stories and characters compel me.
You know, I love that because you're open inspiration. I actually have it's different, but a similar process in that like being open and letting the story come to you, but this idea that you have to be working, right? And that you have to keep pushing forward and then grow within that. Like a lot of people sit back and wait for inspiration and never write. And I think that's a huge mistake.
I absolutely hear that a lot from people. And one thing I've noticed, and I know that we have at least one other published author in the crowd, when people find out you're an author, they get very excited. And I would say, you know, at least 6-7 times out of 10, it's, I've always wanted to do that. And I was at an event in May with another author that I know, and I really admire her. She's fantastic. And a woman came up to us and said, I've always wanted to write. How do I do it? And I said, oh, you should just make yourself open to it and put some time into it. And my author friend cut me off. She goes, no, but share type. And so it's, she said, you can wonder and dream all you want, but if you're not actually writing things down and working on it. And so I try to work every day on my creative art. So I know that I have the most creativity in the morning. So I structure that in the morning I wake up. When I wake up, I try to do things, whether it's sketching, maybe it's just editing. Maybe it's not actually creating new scenes. Maybe it's even just working on the, you know, social media art to promote the book. But I'm always doing something related to my creativity every morning. So you do always have to be working. You know, a lot of people say, oh, someday I want to write it, someday I want to write it. It's not going to write itself. And there are a lot of authors who believe in this idea that an idea wants to be born. And if you don't do it, someone else will, which is, you sometimes see the simultaneous movies like Deep Impact and Armageddon came out at the same time. And it's like, oh, that story wanted to be told and people grabbed onto it. If you don't tell the story, it's not going to be told. So it's you do have to be working and you have to be willing to put in the time to do it.
I mean, that's the magic of this, right? Because you're making this thing out of old cloth, and wherever it's coming from and however you're putting it together, it won't exist unless you do that work. Mm-hmm. I've noticed there really is a difference. The people who produce and those who don't, and the ones who produce are doing just what you say. Like they just will work, you know, and whether it's they're working on something, it doesn't get published or maybe it doesn't work out, but they just keep working. And the ones who persist are the ones who tend to get published.
And there are different methods that work for different people. I have friends who have word count. Every day they have to type 3,000 or 5,000, however many words. I have friends that that's their method. I don't do that for myself, but I do make sure I'm doing something with my creativity and moving my projects forward. Some people, it's that they have to be doing certain amounts of things every day. It is a different process for every author.
So I see three books up here. How did this one differ in your writing process, or not necessarily the process, but how did it feel? Like the more you write, do things change? Like, did it feel different? Was it easier? Was it harder?
This was radically different because this is the first book I did research and interviews for. So Lucy Pryor it's an epistolary novel. So every single chapter is a standalone letter. It's like The Color Purple or Dangerous Liaisons. There's no connective prose at all. So that was just from my head of this woman writing letters. Fireflies in a Jar, that process was, again, I was writing this woman's story of her midlife coming of age. She never really became who she was until her mid-30s. And I realized in that one, I had to retroactively do some planning and figure out what age would she and her brother and sister have been when all these pivotal events happened. This one, I had all these snippets together and I knew they all made up the story, but I have never been incarcerated. I've never helped a family member who's been incarcerated. I really didn't know the emotional truth of the experience. And so I first started reaching out to some volunteers who worked with programs in prisons and also after release to help people reenter society. And then I got in touch with people who've been in prison, with family members who've helped people after, with parole officers, defense attorneys. I spoke to a lot of different people, people who are advocates for making reentry easier and taking down some of the barriers that exist both at the federal and state level. And so this ended up taking a completely different form, because when I started, it was just Matt's point of view and his journey. And I realized that Jenny, as the sister who was trying to help him, is in a very untold story in our country. And we have the highest incarcerated population of any developed country. For every 100,000 people, we have 580 incarcerated, compared to Canada, who has 80, and Germany has 67. So we are a heavily incarcerated population. And as I started telling people what I was working on, when they'd say, what are you working on now? People actually started telling me stories, and people I've known for a long time even would say, hey, I was Jenny. And so it really helped me. So I did a lot of interviews and research and really tried to put in the emotional truth of what it's like both to be the person coming out of prison, but also to be the family member who's just hoping against hope that you can help someone thrive when there are a lot of systemic challenges that make it difficult.
So there's so much there. Let's unpack it a little bit. So you talk about like an emotional truth. When you're asking people about their experience or relying on memory, we know how faulty memory is and how people look at things through different lenses. How like when you are doing interviews to try to get to some sort of objective truth, right? When you're doing that, how do you like vet the information, or how do you compare conflicting stories?
So some of it, I was lucky enough to talk to some people who knew each other and were connected, so I could compare notes between their interviews without telling, I didn't say, oh, so-and-so said this when I interviewed them about your time coming out. And I would sort of check where those similarities were, which was very informative because the book does alternate. Matt and Jenny have very different perspectives on life. But also when I was interviewing people, so for instance, people who had been incarcerated, I looked for some of the similarities between their stories. A lot of people talked about the technology gap, which is huge in this book, because Matt goes into prison in January 1998. He gets released in August 2018. he didn't even know what the internet was, and now he has to do everything by his smartphone. That came up in a lot of the interviews. The emotional confusion around children was something that came up a lot, because when you're in prison, you're in a very controlled environment. And the number of people he used a phrase, very similar wording of, prison is scary, but the real world is scarier, and children are a huge element of surprise and chaos. So I wasn't probing in my interviews. I didn't force people to tell me anything they weren't comfortable with. And I actually had a standard set of questions for the different people I was talking to. And I sent them in advance and said, anything you're not comfortable talking about, that's off limits. That's fine. Some people were much more closed off in what they were willing to talk about with their emotional experiences. And other people were very open books. And that itself informed some of the characters in the book. There's a character, Trey, who says, I'm an open book. People can learn from my experiences. What do I care? There are also people who asked not to be included in my acknowledgments. So this, everything, even if it wasn't someone telling me something I could vet was true, everything sort of informed the overall truth of the story.
So we have so many authors that listen to this. How did you go about that? Because I think it's a little daunting. A lot of authors are very introverted, right? And they, or maybe they're writing about a world they don't know anything about. Like, kind of walk us through that process. Like, how do you reach out? How do you find people? What is your approach? You know, what problems did you have?
It is terrifying. I'm an introvert, and I am a marketing director by day, so I have to be public facing. After I'm public facing, I will go crawl into my bed and take a nap or a bubble bath and just recharge, because I'm an introvert as well. It is terrifying, because you do have to put yourself out there and reach out to people, and some people will never get back to you. Some people will say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Some people committed to interviews and then got a little squirrely and said, you know what, actually, I really want that time behind me. I'm not going to talk about it. So one, you need to be respectful to people, but you also need to be willing to take no, to be ghosted. It's not pleasant, but it's just part of being an author anyway. You're going to get rejected at different points, whether you're submitting a book for publication or for a festival or for, you know, you want to go to an author event. You need to develop a thick skin. If you're someone who feels like you're going to take it too personally, Stephen King's On Writing is very informative. He actually used to keep a wall of his rejections. He had a little pen on his wall that he would slap. He would print out his rejections and slap them up on the wall. It is difficult to reach out to strangers. I know that, because I don't like it either, but you just have to learn. Otherwise, I would have missed so many details that people who've read the book, who have been in either Jenny or Matt's situations or other people in attorney or Department of Corrections roles, they've reached out to me and said, you did your research. And in fact, one of my ARC readers who I didn't know, that's another thing. I had to ask people, will you read an advanced copy of my book? That's terrifying. Because at that point, you're pretty done with the book. What if they come back and it's a disaster and you can't control the review? And they've got a platform. I did not know that, but the ARC reader was a social worker in Maryland, and she actually put in her review, this author did her research. So as painful as it is to put yourself out there, it's absolutely worth it.
That's got to make you feel great, right? When you get that, okay, I got it right. Because every author, even when they're writing fiction, they're worried, am I getting something wrong? Am I going to get called out for screwing something up? So I love the idea of the thick skin. I framed one of my best rejections, and I had it on the wall because I thought it was so funny, you know. But when you're reaching out to these folks, like, how do you find them? I want to find someone who, you know, was in prison for 10 years. How did you locate the people? And then what was your approach? Like, what specifically did you ask?
I started broadly, and sometimes it was just cold emails out to nonprofits that support people through reentry. Sometimes it was in conversation with someone of, oh, actually, I used to do some volunteer work. So again, it's that being open, just like you're open to creative ideas, be open to connections. The world is all based on connections, and you never know. There's the weirdest like coincidences of people who know each other. So a lot of the people that I interviewed, I'd never known before, but I was put in touch with them, or someone would say, you should talk to this person and be open to that. And then you actually have to send the person an email saying, hi, you don't know me. I need a favor from you. You're a very busy person. I mean, in some cases, I was reaching out to authors who do volunteer work in these spaces, and I know they don't have the time. And so you just have to put yourself out there. And so it was a mixture of cold emails, unsolicited emails to nonprofits or to people who work with organizations supporting reentry. And then also through a personal network of someone saying, I know someone, I know someone, I know someone. And then I worked on developing the questions to inform this, and then I stayed in touch with people, and that's important. So I actually, people who I interviewed got to read every draft, and they could tell me if something hit the mark or it didn't. And, you know, in one case, it was a friend of mine who's she's a criminal defense attorney. I just happened to mention what I was working on, and suddenly I realized she wanted to know more about what I was working on. She became one of my beta readers during the draft process, and she was able to give me insights that I never would have known because I've never been a criminal defense attorney. So the details you find out from that, it makes the book that much more relatable, because someone reading this book has been through these experiences, which again, a lot of people in the United States have been through these experiences. They're going to know if you know what you're talking about or not. And if I hadn't done those interviews, I think this would have just been full of cliches and it would have been emotionally hollow.
So I don't want to beat it to death, but just so your initial outreach, mm-hmm. is it just like you're saying, hey, I'm an author, I'm writing a book, mm-hmm. this is kind of what it's about. Would you be open to it? Or are you sending questions to initially?
It depended on who I was talking to. For the people I was going to do interviews with about their personal experiences, I sent them the opening chapter of the book that I'd already written so that they could see what I was doing. I also sent them a synopsis saying, this is not about the prison experience. I'm not going to be talking about what they did in prison. I'm not, you know, if you talk to me, I won't ask you where you served, how long you served, why you served. There are guardrails. You don't have to divulge anything you don't want to. So I gave them a sample of what the book was going to look like because I already had that developed by the time I reached out to them. For the nonprofits, you know, they're very busy. They're volunteer run. For the most part, I would actually send them a synopsis of the book as well as a list of questions of what I was looking for. And, you know, very upfront about, I know you don't have time. If you could even speak to me for 5 minutes and can't, you know, or if you can even email me back about some of these questions, you have to work with people with the availability they have. Not everyone can do hour long interviews with you. Some people can send you one nonprofit actually sent me a lovely email that said, we absolutely love that you're doing this. We don't have time to help you, but we want people to read this book. So in solidarity, get it out there. And that meant a lot to me.
So what was the most, you mentioned like the detail, right? You're talking to a defense attorney. What was the most surprising thing that came from this research and the interviews? Because the interviews you're doing, some authors do it, but a lot of them don't. So you did extensive interviews, right? So what shocked you the most in your research?
So some of what shocked me is the people who've been doing this for a long time, but at different parts of the country. I learned that people's experiences, depending on where they are in the country, dictates their experiences of reentry because we don't have federal programs really to help. So for instance, I set this in Maryland because out of 24 jurisdictions in Maryland, only 7 have reentry support programs. So that greatly reduces the ability of someone to stay out of prison. But some of what surprised me was the different experiences. So for instance, the criminal defense attorney said in reading one of the drafts, I feel like the parole officer comes across as more of a life coach or a social worker. They're too kind. And I said, well, you know, that's actually interesting because I spoke to this parole officer and did the interview and some of the dialogue is directly from that interview. And so just the gaps in what people's experiences are in different parts of the country of where there are people who see reentry as their calling and helping people succeed and stay out versus other parts of the country where you have a defense attorney who knows if they can't keep someone out of prison, they're on a ramp where they're going to keep circling back into prison over and over. So it was the inconsistency in people's experiences within the same country. I mean, it was drastically different, both when people are going to trial, when they're getting sentenced, and then when they're coming out, depending on what state you're in, it can greatly drastically alter. And originally the book, when I was writing it, was set in Virginia. But in my research, Maryland is much, much worse to be arrested and convicted in because, you know, I learned things about the judicial discretion where a judge can add on extra time. I mean, you know, they're, at the time that the book is set, Maryland was second only behind Alabama in trying children as adults. So there, your luck is determined by where you live, which is so true for so many parts of American life.
So you mentioned like the reentry programs, and intuitively that sounds like they'd be effective, right? But there are a lot of things that intuitively seem right, but then the data doesn't support it. Is there actual data to show that people going through reentry programs have a lower recidivism rate over like, you know, like it's like 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years?
Absolutely. There are a ton of statistics about that. Again, within each state, you also have to look at the local, state, and federal prisons for those statistics. So the research actually became exhausting at one point, and I had to pare back what I was looking at. But the research does show that without a reentry program, you are much more likely. In fact, when the book starts in 2018, at that time, it was a 40% likelihood of being rearrested within your first 90 days in Maryland. And again, Maryland, 7 out of 24 jurisdictions have reentry support. Places where there's more, you might have only 12 or 19%. So recidivism is directly related to the reentry support. And I mean, even today in 2026, only 23 states in this country require a prison to help an incarcerated person have a photo ID by the time they're released. What can you do now without a photo ID?
So was this one of the things you wanted to talk about in the book? And like, how do you balance like messaging in the book with plot and the craft of storytelling?
I write literary fiction, so it's ultimately character driven, dialogue heavy. The plot is, as I said, I'm not a plotter. I let the story take me where I am. Sometimes my editor would have to peel me back from some of the character rich scenes too far. But for me, effective messaging isn't where you're telling someone something. It's where you're showing. I watch a lot of war movies, and there's an old saying that the best war movie is the anti-war movie, which is why I think The Thin Red Line is the best World War II movie. And so it's more effective when you don't preach about how bad something is. You just show. If you're going to persuade people. And again, I'm not writing to any specific agenda, but this book, as it evolved, like I said, it started with a confrontation scene between Matt and another character about how that character had been treated while he'd been incarcerated. And, you know, there was the balance of how much do I go into, what is it really like for the family members, because I've done some volunteer work as well. And there's a lot that people don't understand, which is when someone is incarcerated, the entire community is affected because that person is taken out of the community. And then their family is burdened with the shame and the guilt. And do we tell people? Do we not? Do we support them? Do we not? I got to a point with the book where I didn't want to include too much that was messaging, but I wanted it to be emotionally truthful. And at the heart of it, it really is a story of family dynamics, reunion, atonement, forgiveness. We have this supposed system where you serve your time. We hear that phrase, but we don't actually live that in this country. Once you've been incarcerated, you are marked for life. And for some reason, we can all have sympathy for Jean Valjean in Les Mis. When he can't get a job because of his parole ticket, we all go see that on Broadway. But in our own modern times, we can't extend that empathy to people who've been incarcerated in the United States. So as I did the interviews, I took a lot more emotional weight about the book because as people told me, the reason they agreed to do the interview is because this is a story that's not often told. And if someone is going to pick up one book about this topic, they hope that the book touches people. And so ultimately, it was more about the emotional connection than are people going to walk away knowing statistics.
Is that the primary takeaway you want readers to have, like thinking about the family, or is it the empathy for the defendant, or like what is the main message that you want people to get from this?
It's about people having that empathy for a second chance. I'm a big believer in second chances. That's why one of my favorite Christmas movies ever is The Muppet Christmas Carol. I mean, who has a better second chance than Scrooge? Scrooge is like at the 1 yard line of his life. He's almost out of time to change who he is. He does, and everyone forgives him and embraces him and celebrates him for that. And that's such an ideal. But we don't really do that here. You know, when we find out someone's something wrong, we tend to mark them for life. But then we're very inconsistent in how we do that. You know, Martha Stewart served time in a corrections facility, but how often is she introduced as convicted felon Martha Stewart? Why was she able to shake that off? And actually, it helped her brand cachet afterwards, because like, oh, Martha, she served her time. But this person down the street who served their time, I don't want them to move into my neighborhood.
You know, I can honestly tell you, I'm a little surprised a book about incarcerations, literary fiction, and the Muppet Christmas movie comes up. I did not see that coming.
I am delighted to surprise.
All right, so your prose is really lovely, and I mean, it's really well written. So let's talk a little bit about the actual craft here. Like, what is like an authorial voice? Like, what is your voice, and who would you compare it to?
I read a lot of different genres, and I am drawn to authors who make characters very distinct and have distinct voices for each character. If I read a book and I can't remember, wait, who is this person again? And I'm flipping back to the family tree at the beginning of the book, that doesn't attract me. As an author, I think it's really important that each character, you wouldn't even need to have a dialogue tag to know who was saying that. And so that's what I focus on developing. Is this character distinct? Do you know who this character is? And so I actually, as an author, take time to get to know my characters, different thoughts about, for instance, Jenny in this book. Jenny, it's not important to her voice, but her favorite meal is breakfast for dinner. But you start to unpack why that is. Well, Jenny was 11 when her brother went to prison. Jenny's childhood ended then. She was bullied. She was harassed. She was ostracized. She didn't get to have a childhood from then on out. So as an adult, she gravitates towards things that let her have those little bits of childhood. So it's not even always just the dialogue voice, but it's also the characteristics of that. And so as an author for literary fiction, it really is, it's not the plot. It's not the pacing. It's not some genre fiction where you know what's going to happen. It's really about how are the characters reacting to each other. It's almost like a chemical laboratory where you throw the characters together and see what happens. And so as an author, I just want to make sure you always feel like you know the characters and you have a reaction to the characters. I don't want you to like them all. I actually wrote an entire character in this book during revisions. His name is Santos. He's written to be a low-stakes foil, and he is just an unrepentant asshole for no reason. I don't want you to love him, but I want you to know his voice and his mannerisms.
So is there a difference between character voice and the author's, like, maybe stylistic choices that, you know, I'm sure you've picked up writing without even looking at who wrote it, you can tell, right, by the way they wrote the book.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody's going to pick up Vonnegut and mistake it for Isabel Allende. They're very different in their voices, but they're both, I think, masters at their voice, having characters who are distinct with voices. I think authors, you can sort of tell who's writing a book. You know, if you've read a lot of a single author, you start to sort of anticipate how that author is going to write different characters or write different scenes. But again, having those distinct characters within that author's overall voice, I think, is important. And I'm one of those people who, once I fall in love with an author's writing, I will seek out their entire catalog and read it. And I actually love, as a reader, that you can get used to, you know what, I need, for me, Gabriel Garcia Marquez is, if I need to, like, reset after a book maybe I didn't love or it left me unsettled, I know exactly what I'm going to get. Even if it's something of his I've never read before, I know what I'm getting. And same with classic sci-fi, with Asimov, Clark, Bradbury, or, Ursula K. Le Guin. If I need something that I know, like, none of their stories are the same. But there's a feel of that author. And I think that the more you write, I think even if you compare my first novel to this, you can see my overall style as an author, but I think it's going to continue to develop over time.
So you're writing literary fiction, but you're reading everything.
Everything I read. It's actually funny. There's a little bit of a fight on Bookstagram right now. If you're on Instagram, there's a corner of Instagram called Bookstagram for readers and authors and people who just love books. And sometimes there's drama. And right now the drama is, do you seek out diverse authors? Or do you only read the same author over and over? And I thought that was bizarre because I actually went and looked at my bookshelf and most of my books are actually translated fiction. So I was like, the idea that you would, of all world literature, close yourself off to something, it's interesting to me. So I read everything from every time period, from, you know, classical Greek literature to, you know, Japanese literature, medieval Spanish to modern, you know, beach reads, whatever. I just love to read. And if an author is good, it doesn't matter what genre it is. If they're taking you somewhere in the story, that's all I care about. I care about, am I immersed?
Do you remember which authors first got you excited about writing?
Oh, gosh. When I was a kid, Chronicles of Narnia was huge because the first stories, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is centered on a girl. A little girl is the protagonist, which it was awesome. You know, it was a lot of those books like Island of the Blue Dolphins by Scott O'Dell, Catherine Patterson, who wrote Bridget Terabithia. A lot of children's authors really shaped me. Beverly Cleary with the Ramona books, because Ramona wasn't necessarily a likable protagonist. She was a little girl who was rough around the edges. You know, the Anne of Green Gables, all of those kind of books. But I am the fourth of five kids, and we are very spread out age-wise. So I had older siblings just giving me books constantly in different genres. They all had different interests. You know, my older sister gave me The Hobbit to read. And then one of my brothers was like, no, Lord of the Rings is the real story. And so, like, I just remember just different books and authors that I connected with as a kid that made me excited to read. And then as an adult, every time you discovered someone new, like, you know, if you would read, I also like to be read to because I'm a younger sibling and I used to not like to go to bed until someone read me a story. And I actually, sometimes at sleepovers, could convince friends to read to me and I would discover new authors that way and go, oh, I had a friend read Ray Bradbury short stories to me in elementary school. And Ray Bradbury as a kid, I know it's weird to be like, I was a fourth grade girl who loved Ray Bradbury, but he was formative to me.
So what is it about story that like captivates us? Like, you know, it's such an interesting thing, right? That somebody's doing. So you like being read to, it's, there's a long tradition of this, right? So like, what is it about that draws your attention and makes you want to like be in this world?
I think especially I grew up in a house with a lot of people. And so you're overstimulated. There's too many different things hitting you every day. When you're in a really good story, whether it's because there's a character scene that's emotionally resonant and wraps you up, or it's a plot twist. I mean, I read a lot of Agatha Christie growing up, too, because my sister was addicted to Agatha Christie. She also read me Edgar Allan Poe short stories in elementary school to go to sleep, too. So she put me to sleep to The Cask of Amontillado. But I loved it because I didn't know where it was going. So I love that a story can take you out of the chaos and just put you into a state where you're absolutely present and you're not thinking about anything else. You're not reading anything. You're not doom scrolling. You're not worrying or stressing. You're just focused. So a really good story is one that pulls you in fully and gets your attention and takes you out of your present life. And that's what, you know, I hope I do with my fiction.
Do you remember the moment when you decided you want to write these things?
I actually started writing in elementary school. I actually wrote a murder mystery novel in fifth grade. It was all of 12 pages, but I thought it was a novel. But I wrote a lot as a kid. I wrote poems, I wrote plays, I wrote short stories and what I thought were books. But I didn't really share them because I'm a visual artist as well. And that you can't hide. If you're working in art class in school, people will see what you're working on. And so even in elementary school, I was exhibiting my visual artwork. My writing made me feel vulnerable sharing that because there's one thing about you've made something that's pretty and it's easy for people to like. There's something different about sharing your writing where people start to say, is that what was in your head? Is that what you think? Wait, who is that character supposed to be? Was that based on something? And so it made me feel vulnerable. So even though I've been writing my entire life, it wasn't until, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, I went to dinner with my husband and I was like, all right, I have a notebook with 42 stories that I have going in different phases. Should I do something with these like in my life or just let it go? And he knows that if I do something, I do it all the way. So I said, if I'm actually going to focus on writing, then I want to publish. I want to go out. I want to be an author. I want to do the whole thing. And so it was really just taking a risk a couple years ago and finally deciding to publicly share what I'd been. You know, I haven't even shared my writing with my husband at that point. I was terrified and it was very hard to share because some people do ask the questions of like, oh, is that what you think? Is that person an avatar for you?
So, I mean, that's really common with authors, right? And you are sharing something personal. It all does come out of your head, but all art, right, has emotion in it. And so why is it that people focus more on that linkage between the artist and what they're feeling and thinking in the written word as opposed to like a painting, for example?
I don't know because my artwork is very bizarre and all over the place. I mean, I don't do the same thing every time I draw and paint. Again, I'll wake up, I've had a vivid dream with a fully formed painting. I sketch it out and good, I'm going to do that later. And I sometimes my paintings are, you know, really weird and surreal. And sometimes they're objective of and no one ever says like, what were you thinking that day? No, I don't ever get those questions about my visual art with my writing. You know, I recently shared a draft of a short story that I'm working on and I got, oh, was it a rough day? Are you working through some female rage? And it's like, I know I just had a story in my head I needed to get out, but there is something about, and I think maybe it's because readers connect emotionally. So they think they want to understand, does this author see me? Because that's something that's really, really validating and satisfying as an author. When someone says, I experienced that. You've got my experience right. I felt seen by you. I actually love with Fireflies in a Jar because she makes it a lot of terrible mistakes. I've received text messages from people that were like, I feel very attacked right now about my life choices. And with Lucy Pryor, I actually had people sending me texts that were like, I'm full on crying right now. But then they would follow it up with, is that from this? And I was like, no, it's fiction. And do you know what's going on up there? I'm not intentionally thinking of this as anything, but because I'm always open to inspiration, if I see something funny happen, I write it down. I mean, even last night when we had some bizarre experiences at a concert at Wolf Trap, I was like, that's all future material. And I don't know those people, but that's all scenarios that are going to go into a book someday.
Yeah, everything is material to an author, right? I think that's really insightful about people wanting to be seen, because I think the difference between maybe visual art and the written art is the reader is creating their own story in their head. You're basically giving them a manual to create something that's unique to them, right? There's no two readers read a story exactly the same way. So you might have hit that one right on the head.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm trying to remember if it was, who was it? I'm trying to remember the author who said that when you read a book, you're actually communing with the past because you are creating a unique experience that the author couldn't have even anticipated. And the author, I'm going to remember as soon as we're done talking, but the author basically compared reading a book to performing a piece of music, where the music notes are written, but every musician will bring a different instrument, capability, improvisation, and backstory and emotion to the performance of that music. And that's really what a reader is doing. And I don't think readers always get credit for being active participants in the creative process, but they really are, because some of the things that people will respond to in my books, because they are very emotional books, I will get conflicting things from people in the same family. I had actually had a family book club take Lucy Pryor, and the things that some people will say, oh, I felt like that was really unfair. Other people are like, yeah, I was like, say it, girl. And so I think for readers, they do like to feel involved. I'm also someone who sometimes I'm busy and I just want to read something that's like, don't make me think. But otherwise, my favorite books are ones that really, you know, the other night I stayed up too late reading Night of the Living Res by Morgan Talty about its short stories about growing up on the Penobscot Indian Reservation in Maine. And I thought, oh, for closure, I'll finish the book. And then afterwards, I was so emotionally shaken. I was like, I'll never recover from this. I can't sleep. I loved it. Everyone should read this. It wrecked me.
So when you're writing, do you find that same like meditative quality when you're disappearing as a reader into a work?
Yes. And I am someone who believes you get your rough drafts out. And so because I don't plot, I will just sit and write and write. I write by hand a lot in my notebooks, but also if I'm typing, I just get into a groove and a flow state and I write whatever comes to me. I don't fix, I don't do line edits. I don't even try and make sure if a character's name doesn't come to me yet, they get a placeholder name that says mother's name, and I move on and I write so quickly and I get my drafts out. And then sometimes I will actually go back when I'm editing and be completely surprised and go, wait, what? I had them do that? No.
Yeah, are you writing fast because you're trying to keep a grasp of the story that's unfolding? Or what are the reasons?
It is that, because sometimes my fingers don't type as fast as this thing happening in my head, which I know a lot of writers experience, where it's like your brain, especially for those of us who are transcribing what we're hearing versus people who are trying to say, all right, now what would my character say? If there are a lot of authors like me who hear or see the scenes being delivered to you, so you're just trying to capture it in real time. Other times it's because, again, I'm working on multiple projects at once, and I know a few other authors and artists I've talked to about this, where our brains cannot rest until you have gotten it out onto a canvas or a page, and it's like having a creative exorcism that gives your mind rest. And so sometimes it's writing quickly because I just need this thing out of my head. I need this character to leave me alone. Like the cranky old intelligence community veteran the other night, Sandra, she's insufferable. She wouldn't stop. So I had to get her out on the page so I don't have to hear her anymore.
So you told us a little bit about your process and how you sit down, you're doing something every day and you're sort of letting it come to you. Do you have any benchmarks that you're shooting for? Like, you want to have a book done in a certain amount of time? Or like, I guess it's curious, like, because you're seeing these snippets and at some point you go, okay, these go together, it's a narrative. Like at that point, because you're not a plotter, do you go back and look at, okay, this is like maybe the journey of a character from beginning to end? Like walk us through that a little.
Yeah, so this is actually a really good example of that, because the book does take place, it's in sections of each month of the year and the different things that happen at that. So I'd had all these snippets and then I started realizing it doesn't make sense emotionally at that point in his journey for him to have had this happen. So I need to move it. So I actually did writing out the months of the year and moving the key milestone moments of, no, there's no way he would be that well adjusted this early. That's too emotionally mature for where he is. So I need to move that to later. And he has to have earned that, because the reader has to believe he's going to fumble and make some bad decisions before he makes a good one. And that's why I think as a writer, you have to be very open during the editing process to letting that change. Because this one I did stitch together over time. And then also when I did the timelines and I looked, because it takes place in 2018, I looked and said, wait, there's a chapter that takes place during Glen Echo's opening weekend for the carousel at Glen Echo Park. I actually had to go look up, wait, when did the park open that year? Okay, I actually need to move back to a different month. So it's a lot of, I'm very open to rewriting and moving things around.
So because we have so many authors who watch this, I always ask some process questions here. What are you using to write?
I use, again, handwriting and notebooks. I also will do full scenes on my voice memos when I'm out walking, especially walking my dogs. I will, if I'm hearing dialogue, I write it. And then when I actually sit down on my laptop, it's actually my iPad that I use for my writing. And I have the, I use Pages, which is the native word processing program on a Mac. And then for hardware, I recently got, as a Christmas present, the QWERTY typewriter, which actually feels like a manual typewriter, which actually is so much more satisfying to type on. And I will only use that for writing from now on.
Our process is so similar. I have that same typewriter.
Do you really?
Yes.
It's so much fun. It lets you feel, there's something, for those of you who don't know, it looks like one of those old mechanical typewriters where it actually has like the stadium seating for the keys. And it's they're the round keys. And again, I'm the fourth out of five kids. My sister, when she went to school, had to type her papers. And me, being the little creative I was, would go and type on the typewriter. So for me, that typewriter actually, I can now do like 1,200 words an hour with that thing. I can fly with that. And it feels silly because I thought, you know, you keep seeing ads for something. You're like, this is a trend. I don't want that. And then I actually got it and I was like, this is so tactilely satisfying. I feel like Hemingway over here.
Because they say your brain interacts differently. There's a different neurological process if you're writing by hand or whatever. But this does give you that tactile connection, right? It's different.
Yeah. It really does. And I still do default, though, to a lot to pen to paper, though. And I think that's tied to my being a visual artist as well, where as a painter, I focus primarily on painting, drawing, and calligraphy, and some printmaking, but anything where I can actually be physically feeling that I'm putting the paint to the canvas, or actually there is a physical sensation in the creative process that you lose when it's separated.
I also dictate a lot. So like, what is it about, did it take time for you to develop the ability walking and not seeing a story in front of you to actually get it down?
No, because I mean, it's in my head anyway. So I'm either going to say it to my dog or say it to my voice memo. So this one is more productive and actually keeps it.
You know, like Stephen King says, like, don't write anything down because if it's a good idea, it'll stick with you. But I think the Anne Lamott idea is much better, because I don't know about you, but I'll forget about something like 5 minutes later.
I have, on the very rare occasion where I have no way to capture a story, like let's say I'm in some occasion where I cannot on my phone even discreetly put down an idea, I actually am mourning in real time, because I know there's a distinct possibility I'll never get that dialogue back. I'll never get that scene back. I'll never get the idea for that story. Like, there's whole stories where I'm afraid that the seed of that story is gone, because again, I get little snippets and that, you know, germinate over time. And if I can't capture it, I mean, the Stephen King's process clearly works for him, but I'm definitely more of the Anne Lamott of, you better capture that. Because what happens is, if you don't, someone else is going to capture that idea somewhere out there, and you're going to see them publish a book and go, I could have done that.
Have you ever like had the idea, like you're seeing some kind of interaction or conflict and you want to write but you can't, and then when you go to sit down later, you remember the idea, but it's not coming?
No, not so much. But I will know in real time that the dialogue doesn't match the dialogue I heard before, and then I feel like I missed something. So I'll remember the highlight of, oh, This thing came into my brain about a conflict scene between these two characters, and I'll hear the whole dialogue and think, it's a shame I can't capture this. When I go to sit down to write it, I get frustrated when I can't recall the exact dialogue, because sometimes I feel like that was stronger, and I just have to hope that what I'm putting in approximates it well enough. But it does feel frustrating when you lose the specifics of something, especially when you feel like that specific is a very strong detail.
Do you listen to music, or do you need dead quiet, or are you one of these writers who can write anywhere?
Anywhere. Again, I grew up with one of five kids, but we were also the house that always had a million extra kids in it. And so between all of us doing way too many activities, having friends and teammates and random neighborhood kids, the house was, it was always chaos. So I had to learn to even do my schoolwork to do it against chaos. And you're going to have, between all my siblings with their very different musical genres, you're going to have different music inputs. You're going to have TV. You're going to have kids playing in your backyard. You're going to have noises of the kitchen, of dinner being made. So I learned to focus in chaos. So the one thing I find unnerving for writing is quiet. I cannot do. It's unnerving.
I couldn't agree more. All right, so we're going to go to questions in just a second, but I want to ask you about the business side of this. Mm-hmm. Your background's marketing.
Yes.
So you're making the initial decision versus indie versus traditional versus hybrid. Like, how did you make those decisions?
I am impatient. Anyone who knows me knows that I don't like waiting, and I also have. I now have 97 ideas in my notebook. I have too many ideas at any given time to go through the traditional publishing route. I did try to do querying for all of a hot 2 months, which for those of you not in the literary world, people will sometimes query for 18, 20, or I mean, people query for years before they get an agent. And even then they can get an agent, it falls through, they get an agent, the agent leaves to a different agent. It's a multi-year process to get an agent. Then you have to revise your book for an agent to sell to a publisher, and then the publisher is going to revise it. And maybe in 5 years, your book is on a shelf. And that's just, I have too many ideas. And also, I'm not looking to be a, you know, there are so few authors who reach that Stephen King level. I'm not working for that. I'm working to get my stories out to share them with the world. If people like them and buy them and it resonates, that's a bonus. But the work exists regardless of an audience. So for me, I toyed very, very briefly with the idea of traditional and then just realized, not for me. I write literary fiction, which is already difficult to sell because you're not doing the tropes of what people expect. There's not people can't anticipate the plot points that they would in a cozy mystery. They know what they're getting, or friends to lovers, they know what they're getting. Literary fiction is the Wild West, so it's already a hard sell. I also like to write short stories, which good luck getting an agent with those. And so for me, I thought about it and I did research on what is hard about self-publishing. And the hardest thing routinely is marketing. It is designing your covers. Well, I design my own because I live in Adobe Illustrator anyway, so I can already do that. It's the social media marketing. I do that for a living anyway. I've also done that volunteering anyway. I've done it for dog rescues. I've done it for selling F-35 military jet engines. Marketing principles are the same no matter what you're selling. So it's just a little more fun and gratifying to sell my own ideas than other people's. And it really was, all right, I can do this. But the one thing I knew I needed was an editor. So I did invest in a professional editor. But I realized a lot of what people find daunting about self-publishing is the marketing aspect, from the how do you format the interior pages? How do you get your book even into Ingram? What is Ingram? How do you get into bookstores? How do you get events? How do you get reviews? How do you get awards? And so because marketing is my background, I felt confident in tackling that. And that's one of the things that I've been sharing the most with other authors I meet. And I actually just last week had another author say, can I talk to you a little bit about my marketing plan for my next self-published book? And I'm happy to share, because it is the hardest thing. But when you have a self-published book that you've marketed correctly and done the work with, it's indistinguishable from a traditionally published book.
So just to cutting to the chase on this. So what does work? Because there are 4.1 million books that were published in 2025, right? How do you get out? Like even a big five, like I think 90% of traditionally published big five authors sell less than 2,000 copies.
I know. I've been looking at the stats and feeling very proud of myself. every time I surpass one of those stats, I think, oh, I'm doing all right for myself. A lot of it is the networking, trying different things. Every author's going to have something different that works for them. For me, the in-person events are huge because I'm able to talk to people a little about what is this story, because it's not a typical genre story. Social media is huge. Getting ARC readers, so people who will read your book and put reviews up, that's very big. But I would actually say one of the things that was biggest for me was getting industry reviews and getting the positive Kirkus review for my first novel, Lucy Pryor. It was a very strong review from Kirkus, which I didn't expect because, you know, they're known for, you know, traditional publishing reviews. And that one opened doors for events. It got me into the library system. It gave me validation in an industry where there's still, I think, a mindset that self-published authors are going down to Kinko's to get a spiral-bound copy to hand out to their friends and keep copies in their garage. But the game has changed with Ingram. And so the printers creating my book are the same printers for traditional books. You're getting the same exact paper. It's from the same printer. It's just knowing how to do it. So, what works is treating yourself like a traditional author. Don't treat yourself like a self-published author. You're an author and you're valid and you're just not part of that system, but you have to invest in yourself.
But you're an author, but you're also a publisher now, right? So like when you talk about libraries, that's a lot of effort to get into libraries. How do you do that? Like how do you balance, even from a time aspect, the other side of that? You want to get into bookstores, you want to get into libraries, you have to do all the marketing. How do you do that?
You have to narrow your focus. You're not going to get in everywhere. And that's what disappoints people. And that is one of the big differences. A traditionally published author is going to be more widely distributed with less work from you. I have to reach out to places. And so I had to narrow my scope of, it's not going to be every library. What libraries can I reach out to and say, here's a reason. And again, having sell sheets, which is a traditionally publishing thing that a lot of self-published authors don't have a sell sheet for each of their books. I do. Having the reviews and testimonials, and you have to, again, be ready for rejection. But narrowing your net. So I'm not trying to get into every indie bookstore in the world. I'm starting with the local ones. And recently I've had events in Maryland and Pennsylvania as well. So with every book, it's growing a little. But I will say one of the things I've learned from my friends who are traditionally published is how much marketing they're expected to do. So people may not know that if they're pursuing traditional publishing, you're still expected to be on Substack or create an Instagram persona and be posting content every day. I've met traditionally published authors who hate that aspect of it, but their agents assign them social media work, and that's what they have to do. And so whether you're traditionally published, hybrid, or self, you have to do marketing now. That's just, it's easier than ever to publish a book, which means to rise above the noise, you have to be good at marketing, whether you want to or not.
That's such great advice. All right, I'm going to come around. Does anybody have a question? Let me bring the microphone so it gets picked up on the podcast. I can hold it for you.
Great. My question has to do with the title. How did the title come to you? Did you come into the book with a title in mind? Did the title arise from the book when it was completed or somewhere in the middle?
This one, it rose from the book taking place over that for the course of the first year. And it really didn't solidify until I changed it from being Matt's story to Matt and Jenny's. And then realizing that the book is a broader topic, again, than just Matt's specific journey. And so it's Human of the Year because I think at the end of the day, there's a case for every character in this book to be the Human of the Year. For those of you who read it, when the book was Matt only, Mira was hardly in the book. And she became my beta reader's favorite character. And they're like, Mira is someone I want in my life. Hector, when it was just Matt's story, was Jenny's husband. Once Jenny gets to have her own chapters, Hector becomes the moral compass in the center of the entire story. So it became Human of the Year because it wasn't really just Matt's journey anymore. It was about the dynamics of everyone's trying their best. Everyone's flawed. I did get a review that said that I wrote the Mexican characters too kindly and softly, and they were all flawless. But I argue that the text does not support that because Hector is a lovely person, but he's also vain as hell.
Any other questions here? Yes.
I know you said that you periodically tweak as you write something and then you go back and you tweak it. But other than that, going back in the draft and things, did you pretty much write from chapter one through the end sequentially? Or, and the reason I ask, so when I wrote my book in a different genre, it's a memoir, but, and I went through an agent and whatnot, and so I had a proposal, and in offering up two chapters to go with the proposal, it was certainly the first chapter, and then I asked my collaborator, do you know Brad, I asked my collaborator, okay, so would the second chapter be chapter two? I mean, I'm new, dumb, and stupid. I'd never written it before. And for me, great guidance was, no, Leslie, for you, you need to have your second chapter, the last chapter. So in my process, I wrote the first chapter, and I was writing some other chapters too, but from the get-go, I had to complete the last chapter. Now, in the end, it was golden advice, and it was perfect for the purposes of my book. But back to my question. So do you pretty much go chapter one through chapter 48 or whatever, or do you chop around and do chapter one and then, okay, chapter 16?
So yeah, that question about process and whether you're writing chronologically through the narrative or not is interesting, because absolutely not for me. I skip around, and I will also chop things up and move them. So Lucy Pryor, those letters are not in the same order remotely that they were when I started. Some of that came from reader feedback and also from my editor of, whoa, you have three really, really dark letters in a row. That is too emotionally devastating for your readers. They need to come up for air. So I am completely open to completely reorganizing the flow of a book. Similarly, Fireflies in a Jar, the first chapter, when I first wrote it, the first chapter was actually Sam's childhood and how she came to be a mid-30s woman who didn't even know who she was. She's a professional in Northern Virginia, but she's still deeply closeted. She has no close friends. She has no social life. She doesn't even have a plant that she's keeping alive in her house. How did she get that way? And, you know, during the editing process, that's great backstory on Sam, but that doesn't hook a reader at all. And I ended up moving what I thought was a climactic chapter to be the opening chapter and then folding back. So for me as a writer, I am, again, open to reformatting to what is going to take the reader on the best journey, especially since I'm not writing predictable genre milestones in a book. I have to keep someone wanting to read. And so I might have to reformat things and move things around. So writing chronologically would be wasted for me because I'm going to chop it up anyway.
Any other questions?
I have one more question.
Yes.
I actually have about a million questions, but I'm trying to be frugal here with time. But you said you have at this point 90 something ideas. I'm just curious, like, how life isn't long enough to maybe write 97 novels. So how do you decide which one is going to go first and which ones maybe you just are just going to, it's going to remain an idea that's kind of unrequited?
So that question of what actually gets realized is important to me. I did a painting several years ago called The Artist Sarcophagus, which is a self-portrait of me and doing the, you know, Egyptian pharaoh's kind of pose as a sarcophagus, because I do have a fear. My sketchbooks, I have thousands of sketches. I don't do thousands of final paintings and drawings a year. So I did have this existential moment years ago when I did that painting of what happens to my ideas when I die and all these unrealized ideas. And, you know, I don't want it to be a Harper Lee situation where someone takes it on themselves to publish a book afterwards because I had a start to it, because that didn't turn out very well. But it does concern me. So some of it, again, is being open. So some of those original 42 ideas got grouped together as short stories in My Side of the World, because I looked at them and I had snippets of all these short stories and I said, I'm overwhelmed. I want these all out before I die. Life's unpredictable. Who knows what's going to happen? How do I get these out? And so I was looking at the stories and said, you know what? These are all kind of around death, grief, mourning, loss, fear of death, or obsession with death. And so I sort of pulled those out and said, these are my focus now. But because the way my brain works, I also worked on other things too. So some of those ideas are not going to be novels. Some of them might be, some of the ideas I have are even like children's stories, or one I turned into a one act play and submitted to a play competition, which was not helpful because they said, ooh, this should be a novel. I want more of this. I said, no, that's putting it back on my plate, sirs. But yeah, some of it, I realized a long time ago with my visual art as well, unfortunately, I'm not going to finish everything. No creative person does. I don't think any artist, musician, author, you know, dancer, no one ever dies feeling like they've checked off their checklist. So I think it's just whatever's resonating and getting my attention most of the time is what I pay attention to. So again, I think I'm working on a short story collection is the most important thing right now. But then there's this other novel that keeps nudging at me. So whichever one nudges the loudest is what will win and get my attention for the next thing I publish.
I love that. So one of the things I always ask is if you take a moment and just rate her books on Amazon, it makes a big difference. It's the majority of books are sold on Amazon. So it really does help with discoverability. And if you like what we're doing here with Elaine's Literary Salon, please do that too. And you have books up here you're going to sign?
I do. I have all of my books, my three novels and my short story collection. And also, if I could put a plug in for Goodreads as well, that really helps out authors as well. Even if you're not doing a review as an author, you know, even just getting the volume of starred ratings is helpful. And we don't check. We're not, as an author, going to say, you gave me 4 stars. What gives? No, the volume helps to break in the algorithm and show up for other people too.
And for people who are listening or watching this, where should they go find your work?
My website is my name, BeccaWeastie.com. And so that has my visual art and my written art as well. And that's got links to purchase everything.
Well, Becca, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for coming here, and come back and see us with your next book.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.